Hello and welcome to the IntensiveCareHotline.com podcast. IntensiveCareHotline.com helps families of critically ill patients in intensive care to instantly improve their lives so that they have more control, more power, and more influence, and so that families can stay in control of their and their critically ill loved ones' destiny. I'm your host, Patrick Hutzel, founder and editor of IntensiveCareHotline.com. And as part of our podcast and interview series, today I've got a very special guest, Delia Scales, founder of Vicky Hospitals. Thank you, Delia, for coming on to the show and welcome to the IntensiveCareHotline.com podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, Patrick, and thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm most appreciative.
Oh, that's great. That's great that you come on to the show. And can you please introduce yourself and to our audience and tell us who you are and what you do?
Right. I'm an ex-nurse, and like you, I've worked in the acute areas of public hospitals. I've worked in intensive care. I've worked in neurosurgery. I have postgraduate qualifications in those areas. I've also worked in emergency, and I've also done the general wards. So I've moved around acute areas of large public hospitals, and I've eventually retired. And I'm now involved in websites to try and give patients and family more information about what's actually happening with the disease, the problems they will face when they go to seek treatment, and some of the ways that they can overcome some of those problems some of the time.
Because I guess, just like myself, we have probably both found that, you know, it's not all sort of open and transparent what's happening in hospitals.
I think one of the first things that I would tell patients and families is that the health system is not like any other world. It's not like the commercial world where you see prices displayed openly, where you can openly check out quality in a TripAdvisor-style website. It's not like it's not like any area of society where there's normally openness and discussion about prices and the quality. It's a very antiquated 19th century style of structure where everything is kept very secret.
Absolutely.
And patients have very little control.
Yes, absolutely. Patients have, well, barely any control. And it's probably up to people like yourself and probably myself and other people, of course, to bring transparency into hospitals and into the health system in general. And that leads me sort of to the next question, where your passion obviously is around opening up all Australian hospitals, both public and private, to public debate and clear scrutiny.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. I've spent the weekend shooting a video, a most appalling story of a nice, well-spoken lady who had an accident in India, severe fractured ankle, was told specifically by the Indian doctor, you need surgery within 3 days because it's a complex injury. He gave her 5 days worth of antibiotics. Well, she jumped on a plane to Australia, which was the worst thing she could have done. And 20 days later, she had her first surgery, which was a disaster because she by then had a severe infection and she went on to nearly lose her leg.
Wow.
Solely due to really just complete negligence. And she's now left stating in public she regrets having had private health insurance and feels she should have either stayed in India and had Indian treatment or gone to a public hospital. There are lots of problems that we have at the moment in our health system.
Absolutely. And previously hidden information will be made available on the wikihospital.com.au website, which is your website, obviously, and as much as possible so that transparency and information is publicly available. Can you tell us more about how you actually want to achieve this, and also what led you to believe that there is a need for such information in the public domain? I mean, you've given us now a quick example, but I'm sure you could tell us about numerous other examples.
Sure. Okay, one of the issues that patients face is there is an astronomical difference in the clinical standards of care from one hospital to another, and that means the way drugs are dosed and charted and given, the way dressings are managed, the way surgical care is undertaken, the amount of observations post-operatively, every aspect of healthcare varies dramatically from one hospital to another. And this is allowed to occur because A, everything is kept so secret, and B, there are no legally obligations. There's no legal obligation to deliver a national unified standard of healthcare.
Well,
so I hope to put up, that's one of my first missions, is to put up best practice standards on the web.
Uh-huh. You're mentioning that there's no sort of standardized treatment across the board. I mean, there is, you know, hospitals have to go through the accreditation process against Australian healthcare standards, but I'm actually not sure how standardized, you know, the whole accreditation process is. Can you shed more light on that? Do you have any insights there about the accreditation?
I understand, like all things with a health bureaucracy, it's very much a tick and flick, you know. Do you have fire controls? Do you have no lift policy? Nobody, as I understand, goes in and says, I want to look at your drug charts. I want to see how often you're doing observations on patients post-surgery. I want to see how you're managing patients in theatre. The actual nuts and bolts of healthcare, what actually happens to the patient, are kept secret.
Yep.
They're actually given by the individual hospital or the individual doctor or the individual nurse as they happen to feel is appropriate.
Yes, yes.
And that's a problem for patients.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess the only time sort of anything will be made transparent if it comes to the worst case scenario, if a patient is actually a coroner's case after patient death, that's the only time really that information will be made available in the public domain. But it should never come to that point where the only time something is made available publicly is after patient's death, you know.
That's correct.
And with what you do, do you think you will get a lot of support from hospitals to make their business practices more transparent? If yes...
That's a joke question, Patrick. No, they will be furious. I expect legal challenges. I expect all sorts of nasty things. I actually have to go in under freedom of information just to extract from hospitals information on what's in their policy and procedure manual on how they deliver dressings, how they deliver observations. The most basic details are literally locked up from anybody's scrutiny, and you have to actually go under FOI and try and drag them out. Now, I expect them to be very unhappy with this process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think that they have anything to gain from it, if so?
No, not really, because the more scrutiny there is, then the more patients and relatives will have power.
Absolutely.
And that will then shift the balance, and then that will cause a snowball of people complaining even more, and they complain quite a bit now. But so, you know, it's in their interest to keep it all very secretive. And I don't think that they can continue to manage things the way they are if more information is available. It will force them to change.
It will force them to change. But the problem and the challenge that I can see, especially in Australia as well, is that, for example, departments of health, whether that's on a federal level or even on a state level, you know, a lot of direction is coming from the Department of Health as well. And, you know, there's another layer of complexity really in the whole health system, and even the Department of Health, from what I can see, they're not interested in making anything publicly available. You know, it's just, another layer of complexity. They're not interested in streamlining processes and really make the customer king, you know.
Well, that's right. That's one of the first things to let patients know that there is no customer service orientation in either the public or the private. There is no concept that the taxpayer, the patient and their family, that they are in any way relevant to the process. The entire process, both public and private, is that you are a sack of potatoes and you are to be dumped on an assembly line process, and we will make all the decisions and you can shut up and have whatever you're treated with, however it's managed. And if you want to complain, then we'll shut you up. Unfortunately,
yes.
That's basically the way it operates.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the problem, what I can see, I mean, I have mainly an extensive intensive care background, there is not only the interests of the hospitals, but there's also often the individual interests of the doctors. And, you know, there's, especially in intensive care, a lot of research going on, and research is a million, if not a billion dollar industry. And sure, a lot of decisions in ICU are being made sort of, okay, well, we treat this patient because we can do research on that patient. Well, we might not treat the other patient because we can't do research on this patient.
That's right, you know? Absolutely.
And it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. And, you know, things like that, I mean, you know, I'm trying to shed some light on those things on my intensivecarehotline.com blog, but I'm sure you could, you know, not only from an intensive care perspective across other areas in hospitals as well, I'm sure people would be highly interested in exposing some of that information.
Look, there are financial deals all through the health system that are never made available to the customer, which is the patient, and that's financial deals between private doctors and their private hospitals, between doctors and pathology clinics, between hospitals and other related services, and as you said, between doctors and research. I mean, health is, unfortunately, a billion-dollar industry. It is at least $140 billion a year with government funding, and then $1,000 a year out-of-pocket cost per person in Australia, according to the Consumers Health Forum of Australia.
Right.
It's a massive industry, and it's the financial aspects are all kept secret, which is wrong.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, transparency would be paramount. And whilst I'm not an advocate of a system like in the US, where, you know, most patients still, even now with Obamacare, pay their health treatment out of pocket, you know, maybe that system in America has some advantages that the customer might have a little bit more influence. I'm not sure. But certainly with the Australian healthcare system, where basically healthcare in public hospitals is for free, well, that sounds good on paper, but where does it leave the patient, really? You know, I mean, it leaves them almost victimized, because all the decision-making is left in a hospital's hands, really. And, you know, some of the things that I have seen over the many years whilst working in ICU is that some patients have been, you know, made NFR. NFR stands for not for resuscitation, for our listeners. And that's often been done without family consent, which is basically violating end-of-life care hospital policies and, more importantly, violating basic human rights. And I can tell people that it happens all the time. And there are, from my perspective, clear indicators that the driving forces behind this behavior are bed and financial pressures, as well as the intensive care team thinking that they know what is best, and I put that in quotes, that they know what is best. And what advice would you have for families of critically ill patients in intensive care who encounter such issues? And do you have any information about end-of-life issues on your website?
Okay, so the question was, is there any advice that I might have for family of a loved one who's in intensive care, who's facing... the family feel they have a lack of control.
Yes, and not only in intensive care. I mean, that's mainly my background, but I mean, end of life issues is something that happens on the ward as well. I mean, people are dying on the ward; they're dying in intensive care. But would you have any advice about, you know, sort of transparency? Because I have come across sort of patients who are made NFR on the ward as well without family consent and without the patient often knowing as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that plenty of times. It's the fights to get a patient in intensive care. The fights to get an intensive care bed are the most extreme fights that probably go on in public hospitals, because an intensive care bed is so expensive, at least $5,000 a day. And we can keep anybody alive. We know this because of the drugs that we use and the ventilators that we have. So all the doctors in all the units know that if their patient comes to intensive care, no matter what their situation, we can keep them alive, or, you know, stabilise them at least. And so the fights to get into an intensive care bed are enormous, and then the fights to get other patients out are absolutely enormous. It's a very hot topic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, sort of from my experience, what I have seen, mainly in public hospitals, not so much in private hospitals, because I worked in both, that, you know, patients get made NFR all the time, without telling anyone, you know, I mean, that's just basically denying patients human rights, you know, and that's in a first world country, you know. I mean,
that's right. And also, what I found in intensive care was that there was a far greater need for what people refer to in a derogatory manner as basic nursing care. I mean, there's a number of people, as you know, in ICU beds who are severely brain damaged,
yes,
who are not going to live a, quote, normal life again.
Yep.
However, they need to have things like seizures managed when they have severe brain injury. They need to be kept clean. They need to be kept comfortable. They need the noise levels dropped. They need to be around their family. And that's one of the reasons I really like your idea of intensive care at home.
Yes.
I've seen a lot of patients in intensive care who didn't need, you know, the inotropes and the ventilation stuff. They really needed to be at home with mum and dad for their final hours or final days in life, you know. So I think we really need to change all of the health system and take the obsession off hospitals and ICU beds and put it back into patient care and, where possible, back into home care.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, from what I can see, having worked in Europe as well, I do think that Australia, especially in the home care sector, is far behind compared to Europe.
Yes.
You know, sort of like with my service, like intensive care at home, it's a service that's been available in Europe for the last 15 years, where patients in end-of-life situations or long-term ventilated patients, they go home. You know, it's a win-win situation.
That's exactly right.
Whereas the health system here in Australia is so political and it's, from my perspective, not competitive at all, because
yes,
it's so highly regulated, and you know, compared to Europe, that makes it hard to sort of innovate and bring new services to the market. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It just means you have to go through a few layers, you know, and I think that eventually a good service, there's always a demand for a good service, and
sure.
You know, and I also think that the win for a hospital to have an ICU bed available, you've just mentioned before that obviously there is always a fight for intensive care beds, you know. I think that's, I do believe that this is sort of a leverage point to bring a new service to the market, because the hospitals basically want to have empty ICU beds, you know.
Well,
so,
that's right, yeah.
So, yeah. Another issue that I encounter in intensive care is that sometimes a withdrawal of treatment or a withdrawal of life support is being, you know, quote-unquote, sold to families of critically ill patients as, quote-unquote, in the best interest of their critically ill loved one, whilst in reality, bed and financial or budget pressures, also a limited mindset of what's possible, and also other competing interests, such as research interests, power play, and other politics, drive the decision-making to how the ICU team positions themselves and also how the intensive care team positions a critically ill patient's prognosis and diagnosis to their family. What advice do you have for families of patients to get insights to the moving parts behind the scenes that more often than not impact on the care of a critically ill patient or any other patient in a hospital? What advice do you have for those families?
Okay, well, with my website, I've come down to putting each disease into six categories.
Right.
First is patient education. Patients need to get onto something high quality like Wikipedia and find out, what does this disease actually mean? What is a grade 4 subarachnoid hemorrhage?
Yes.
What is, you know, extensive brain injury? What is an open book pelvic fracture? What does this actually mean? I'm sorry, but they need to very quickly find out what the disease means. Then they need to find out what is the best way of treating that disease.
Mm-hmm.
Then they need to find out what's the best hospital that specialises in treating that disease.
Yep.
Then they need to find out the costs that they're expected to pay. Then they need to find out the most common errors for that sort of disease, the most common mistakes that are made with patients with that disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, they need to find out what electronic technology supports and devices are available to make treatment and management far easier for them.
Yeah.
So they have to, I think, jump in both boots, get on the internet, get informed, get educated, and then come in and get very involved and very assertive, frankly.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you just mentioned there with assertiveness, I do strongly believe that families or patients they're not assertive. They still have that mindset from 100 years ago often. Well, we think the doctors know best. You know.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately that's promoted, and believe it or not, Patrick, it's promoted far more in the private sector than the public. The private sector is the most antiquated, conservative, backward-looking health system imaginable, where the whole system revolves around the private doctors, who can often come in and behave appallingly. The hospitals there's no concept of healthcare. There's no qualified nursing staff, or very few. There's no allied health services at all. It's simply a doctor-centric 19th century construct. So, you know, private is not better. Private is even worse than the public. So I would say to people, to family and relatives, get online, get educated, then get assistance, get involved with a lawyer, get the patient advocate service, get the patient advocate service or a social worker in the hospital, and start jumping up and down and say, I demand to know now what's happening and I want some control of its process.
Have you got any particular experience with the patient advocate service? Is that an organization that is obviously providing advocacy for patients? I haven't actually heard of them, but
no, it's a new service. There's a lady called Claire who's a lawyer.
Right.
She set up a website in Australia.
Right.
And I know she's just doing this based on experiences with her mother. So if people Google patient advocate, and I put a link to this on the front of my website, then they will find her. And that's a paid service. I believe it's $100 an hour.
Right.
And somebody with legal and health experiences will come and sit into the appointments and then give advice and be an assertive third presence, which is really what's needed.
Right, absolutely. I can tell you, or I can give you an example from last year with my nursing service intensive care at home, where we looked after a terminally ill patient at home. And, you know, she was basically dying at home with gastric CA. But the bottom line there was that I believe she has been denied basic care by one of the big public hospitals. And the family then went back to the hospital's patient advocacy service. And they have been bitterly disappointed by, you know, what the hospital offers as a patient advocacy service. I mean, in reality, there's no advocacy.
I agree. And I've got to tell you, some of the most horrific stories involve people who've gone to the Health Services Commission or the health bureaucracy to file a complaint about people dying in disgraceful circumstances in hospitals and nursing homes, and they have been booted from one department to another and then booted off and told, not our problem. And, you know, in one case, the patient was virtually killed in cold blood. I mean, it's just nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I agree.
You know, there is on paper, most hospitals have advocacy services, but the reality is if a family goes there and, you know, is trying to prove a case, what I often hear then is that the advocacy services are basically telling the families, well, if the medical team has decided, you know, against treating your mother, your sister, whoever it might be, then they might have a reason to do so. And you know, there's nobody standing up for their rights. It's absolutely appalling. And that's why it's so important what you are doing and what I are doing, just bringing transparency in the whole process and educating families, you know, so that they know what's happening behind the scenes, because they often have no idea what's happening behind the scenes.
I know. I have a dream. I mean, Patrick, I call my site Wiki Hospitals, so it's based on WikiLeaks and Wikipedia.
Yep.
And I have a dream of literally going undercover in hospitals and videotaping what goes on. And one of the things in intensive care I'd love to videotape is the arguments that go on around, you know, the big board they have in ICU with all the patients all lined up, who's coming in, who's about to be booted out, their disease, the treating team, and then a big row ensues because the nurse unit manager goes to the bed meeting, comes back by 12 and says, right, I've been told to get five out, I don't care how it's done, get them out.
Yes.
And to let your viewers know, this is because hospitals get fined enormous amounts of money if they have excessive waiting periods in emergency.
Yep.
So they have to push people through at huge speed. They're fined, they're threatened, they're bullied. So the pressure to boot people out of hospitals and out of intensive care beds is enormous.
Of course it is.
And substantial rows occur in all areas, particularly in intensive care, around this issue. So if I could videotape as we've seen every morning, the yep. row over ICU beds, then that would really, that would give people a bit of an idea of what's actually going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's so hidden from, you know, from the general, from the public eye, you know, I mean, and I believe hospitals are making sure it stays hidden from the public eye because they have no interest in shedding any light on what's happening behind the scenes whatsoever. Now, Delia, you mentioned recently that you've spoken to a retired consultant and I was unaware of that, but you mentioned to me that they have to sign a non-disclosure agreement after they've
yes.
retired.
Yes.
Can you speak more about that? And you know, I was totally unaware that this is actually happening, but can you speak more about that?
About senior doctors being forced to sign gag orders,
yes.
I've had complaints from doctor friends about this, yes. This is quite common. This was referring to the public hospital system.
Right.
Where senior doctors are being told that they are not to reveal any discussion of any patient care to anybody whatsoever.
Right.
And it's a gag order, and I'm sure it goes on in the private. As well. So it basically means that healthcare staff are being gagged. So when things do go wrong, when there's bad practice, when there are errors, I mean, instead of openly discussing them and say, look, how can we make things better? We've made a mistake. That's bad. Let's try and fix it.
Yeah.
Everything is crushed and suppressed and covered up. Yeah.
Wow, that is shocking. That is absolutely shocking because it just puts another lid on the pot. You know,
yep.
I mean... That is, I was totally unaware of that this is actually happening and that this is part of their employment conditions.
Yes, that's correct. Yep. And also, when patients have a legal case and if they happen to settle out of court, which most people do, patients and relatives are then forced to sign a gag order before the payments are made, saying that they will never discuss what's actually occurred or name the hospital or the doctor concerned.
Mm.
So there are gag orders. So it's really important, I think, that patients and relatives understand that we healthcare staff, we actually are in many cases, a similar position to them. We're actually quite powerless and we're actually gagged and we actually have lots of things we'd like to say, but we're just not allowed to.
Yes, yes. It's absolutely shocking. And, you know, what you mentioned before with the accreditation process, I do strongly believe that, you know, what you've hinted towards, that the accreditation process is really flawed. And, you know, there are some accreditors coming into hospitals and they look at a little bit of paperwork here and there. But the big questions, they don't ask either. You know, they would never look at the paperwork to see, well, how many patients have been made NFR? Has there
yep.
been family consent? Have there been family meetings conducted?
Yep.
And that
yep.
sort of stuff. You know, they're...
They haven't a clue and they don't care anyway.
No,
yeah.
no, they don't care. They're acting... as, you know, in the Department of Health's interest, you know, sort of not spending too much money and all that sort of thing. You know, it's just the whole system would really need an overhaul and it would have to be competitive from my from what I can
yeah,
see. It's not competitive.
I agree totally, Patrick. I would like to see the entire health system reformed and, you know, I would like to see a WikiLeaks-style exposure of the health system. I would like to see cameras in emergency departments to show how chaotic they are, how
yep.
in enormous amount of cases the wrong patient is in the wrong bed at the wrong time. They shouldn't be coming into ED. How often mistakes are made because of complete lack of technology. How poorly managed many aspects of the health system are. I think really we need... what everybody's trying to prevent. I think we need a big public expose. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And are you with your wiki hospitals.com.au, are you planning to expand that to other English-speaking countries as well, or are you just starting in Australia and then see where it's going from there?
I'd like to take this concept as far as I can, Patrick. I mean, I've got the YouTube channel. I want to load as many people's conversations up as possible. So if any of your viewers are interested in discussing their issues, I'm happy to come out and videotape them.
Yep.
I want videos of people actually talking about their experiences. I want the website giving information and I want the meetup group to bring together patients, health professionals and IT staff and say, look, these are the problems. How can we try and resolve them?
Absolutely, and there are heaps of problems. You know,
Patrick, you know, it's this is really an area of society that needs a big public expose. Yes. Somebody needs to go in and do a WikiLeaks expose. It's like the American military.
Yes.
It's really that bad. I'm sorry, but it is.
It certainly is. You know, and we're talking about, we are in a first world country. We're in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and yet some patients and families in hospitals get denied basic human rights, and decisions are made, on a financial level, but also what really angers me and frustrates me in an intensive care environment, they are often made on research interests, you know, and that's not only in ICU, it's happening on the wards as well. Especially the big public hospitals that are affiliated with universities, a lot of what's driving their practice is research.
Yes. An example of that, my boyfriend recently, as a private patient, and had coronary artery bypass graft times three, he was hounded by private doctors asking if he wanted to transfer to the private, we can do it better, quicker, come across, mate. Then he got hounded by research doctors, harassing him to the nth degree, demanding that he go on a trial. And because I'm a nurse, I directed the whole thing. I directed his care pattern. I just took control and I said, you'll have this, you won't have that, you'll take this drug, you won't take that drug, I want you to see that person, you're not going here, you're going there. So I just took over, I moved in, and I was there, you know, 12 hours a day, and I directed his care, and I'm sorry, but that's really what family need to do. Some of what I saw happen was great, and some was really atrocious. So,
For sure. And, I mean, obviously, people, if they're looking for advice in areas of critical care, they can look at my website and they can look at your website. What other information can people look at? Do you have any other sort of sources in mind where people publish similar things like you and I publish?
That's a very good question, Patrick. I think we're completely on our own. However, there are some new things happening in America. American doctors are getting together publishing apps. There's on my website a list of apps for patients, apps for healthcare professionals. There are apps now where they can give themselves a very good diagnostic tool.
Right.
It's $200 a year for a subscription, but there's quality medical information available. But really, you know, I think that people learn best from other people. So I would really like to see like a big forum where people can get online and say, hey, you know, mum's in intensive care, I've got no idea what to do, and someone else gets on the forum and they says, look, you know, my dad was in ICU and these were the problems and this is what we did. You know, people, I think, really need to know the basics and they need to learn from each other. So I think we need a technology-based information system to bring people together. Yep. To learn from each other.
Absolutely. And you mentioned apps. Whilst my strength is not the technological side, but, you know, you mentioned sort of forums. And I am thinking about, with what I'm doing, my next step might actually be to open up a Facebook group or a LinkedIn group. I'm not sure yet. You know, to sort of give people access where I can answer questions. I'm answering questions already, but I answer them when people send me an email. And there's quite a few emails coming in. But I think, to really sort of give people even more access, I am thinking of starting a Facebook or a LinkedIn group, you know, where people can just, you know, join the group and then they have access to like-minded people and they can exchange their experiences, their ideas, and, you know, get access to information from health professionals who are willing to share their experience and point people in the right directions. I'm pretty sure that you can do similar things by opening up a Facebook or a LinkedIn group, by getting like-minded people on board, you know, who are happy and willing to exchange information, you know.
Sure, and what they have with forums, I mean, some of the forum software is very sophisticated, and with the computer forums, they'll grade the person who's giving advice on the forum. So if you're grade one, you're a basic person, but if you're grade 10, then you're known to have a high level of knowledge about the particular topic. So, I mean, you could have a forum where you could say, you know, a forum for ICU, a forum for emergency, get online, and then you can get different people chatting, plus someone who's graded as being, you know, say grade 10 with their knowledge base, then giving advice information. I really think we just need to blow the lid off the whole health system and just say, guys, let's open it up, let's discuss it. I think we just need to drop a bomb on the legal controls and the secrecy.
Yeah, and look, with dropping a bomb, you know, the reality is that the internet has changed many industries. I do think that the health industry is probably last on the list of industries that's going to be changed by the internet. But, you know, it happened in other industries and it will happen in health as well. It just takes longer for a number of reasons. But I believe that the internet will change the health industry eventually as well, just like it has changed many other industries.
Yeah, great.
And often to the detriment of the big players.
Well, that's right. The internet is a very... It's like the printing press. It's a kind of freedom. It's when people have information, then they can make choices.
Yes.
So the internet gives the nobody and the ability to run their own YouTube channel. The internet gives power to the nothing people, and then it takes power away from the big players, you know.
Absolutely. And I always wonder, you know, with those changes that I mentioned that happened across other industries, the companies that are successful on the internet in other industries are usually the companies who have a blog, who publish information. Whereas I always wonder, why don't have hospitals or, for example, health insurances and so forth, they don't have a blog? Why is that?
Well, I tell you right now, here's an interesting story, Patrick. Dr. Armitage, who's CEO of Private Healthcare Australia, which is, I think it's the body that represents private health funds in Australia. He was so pissed off about bad private hospitals, he published a report. He commissioned and published a report on atrocious private hospitals in Australia, overpriced, substandard, really disgusting.
Yep.
Well, it's gone to Parliament and it's been buried.
Right.
Nobody will allow this to go public. So it's all about secrecy for all levels. So I think let's just be brave and just throw it open to the airwaves and just let people have a voice.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely critical that people have a voice, you know. So, that was a very interesting conversation we've had. I think it's more than overdue that, websites like Intensive Care Hotline and like wikihospitals.com.au, you know, are getting live and then publishing information so that families and patients have access to sort of the behind-the-scenes insights and that they can make informed decisions. So it was really great to have you on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast, and thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having me, Patrick.
And that was a really interesting discussion, and maybe we see you in a future podcast.
Absolutely, and I wish you the very best. I think it's a wonderful service that you're offering to bring patients home and let them be cared for by their own family in a non-medical but supportive environment. That's what most of them really, really need.
Absolutely. All right, Delia, thank you very much for your time again, and talk to you soon. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Bye.